So I have a question for you, though. In terms of your daily practice when you were translating, and I'm only asking you this because I don't know if you know this, but there's a Robert Fitzgerald archive at Harvard, and I went and actually looked at the material from his Odyssey. And he had a practice of copying out by hand in the Greek text, leaving some blank lines, and, you know, kind of taking the amount that he wanted to work on, but first, you know, physically copying out the Greek text and getting that sort of intimacy and familiarity with it. And for him, he was imposing a gradual self-discipline. If you look in the, you know, the collection of these workbooks, you can see him gradually incorporating more observations from commentaries and, but also poetic observations. Really interesting material. And it made me think of two things. First of all, what is your sort of daily process in working with the text and moving to English? But the second is, I'm wondering if we've come to a point with word processing where the things left behind by translators, you know, vanish because people are just processing words on computers. So I'm just wondering if for posterity's sake there was some, you know, ritualized process that we would never be able to tell, if you care to share it.
Well, I probably have some old, you know, manuscripts lying around. You're right, digitally it would all be continually updated, but, you know, you'd print something out. And I think I still have, in fact, the marked up version from Hackett's Readers. So the Iliad had over 1,000 comments, and they're all in the margin, you know, and suggestions. And I think those still exist. I think Hackett still has them. Hackett keeps everything. So that would be the only thing, though. But my process was analogous to Fitzgerald's. I would not copy the Greek out, but I would read it out loud. I would perform it, which I like doing anyway. But for me, it was like an essential, you know, step, the first step. You know, I always had, you know, the Cambridge 6-volume commentary right there. I don't assume that I know everything, you know, about the text. And you just learn so much from these people, these wonderful commentaries, you know. But mostly it would be read it out loud, translate, revise as you go, read it out loud. And if it's tolerable, you know, you let it sit. And Hackett has wonderful readers, really first rate. And they've helped me so much, you know, through the years. And I'm surprised when they let me get away with something. So, for instance, when Diomedes wounds Ares yelled as loud as 9,000 Greek warriors yelling at one time. And I have, you know, Ares yelled as if Diomedes had struck not a god in armor, but a bronze gong 9 miles high. So Bridget, Sheila Murnahan, I said, went back, and Bridget, why did you let this stand? I thought for sure you would get away with this. She said, well, it's just too good. You know? So that's the, so she would catch all sorts of things, but she would give me a little latitude as well. So I really appreciated it.
Do you sense there's a point, you know, initially working very closely from Greek to English, where you have to kind of leave the Greek behind and feel the heft of the English as a real text, kind of congealing?
It's like Karn Ross told Christopher Logue. You know how they work. Christopher Logue knew no Greek. Karn Ross would write out a literal translation. And at some point he writes to him and says, you know, it's very, very important that you have absolutely mastery over the language. That is your own language. So that's what you're producing. So yeah, you can't be semantically precise. I mean, languages just don't map onto each other that way, even though they're both Indo-European and so forth. I've had some experience lately translating Akkadian, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I've just finished that. There's a wonderful Teach Yourself book. Teach Yourself Complete Old Babylonian. This is an aside, I suppose, but I worked my way through that. And the Epic of Gilgamesh happens to be one of those texts in which you can find all sorts of aids. So like every word in the Epic of Gilgamesh is parsed and things. So, you know, you don't have to be an expert. And there's wonderful, very literal, very, very literal translations. And of course, that's not Indo-European. But Greek and Latin and English are, and I think that's important. I think there's something fundamental there that goes unnoticed. And I feel it, you know, as I don't mean simply a matter of, you know, seeing cognates and things like that. It's kind of hard to express, but you expressed it well a moment ago. The what did you say? That the English text has to have sort of some real substance of its own.
Right, that you feel it sort of congeal within its own kind of poetic.
It has to take shape as a poetic text itself.
Right. And
that's essential. That's absolutely essential.
I've used this little distinction with students that, you know, first you translate, which is the painful student task, right, of dragging words over into English, but then you English it, which means you have to kind of consider where you are in the history of the English language and what you're trying to do with it. What is the space and the moment of this communication? What does it mean to you? I was wanting to get back to that a little because, you know, one of the daunting issues specific to Homer is this, you know, wonderful Kunstsprache, this extraordinary poetic language, which is so dangerous to try to render with elements of archaism, et cetera. And there have been attempts in the distant past of trying to do that. Were there traps or, you know, false solutions that you had to work through?
What the French call a faux ami. Sure, you're coming across those all the time. So you find a cognate, well, this is perfect. No, it's not, because it doesn't work in the English composition, the putting together of the English as a life of its own. And so often you're better not going with a cognate. These are things you learn along the way. You know, you have to admire Lattimore's Homer, because he is semantic. It's about as semantic as you can be. It's as if there's the Greek text, and he puts this sort of magic glass in front of it, and the English comes out almost the same word order, line for line. And
it's funny. It's funny that you say that, because that's exactly the problem. I was raised on Lattimore at the University of Chicago. We were told this is all you're allowed to read if you're not reading the Greek.
To read Lattimore.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, if you know the Greek, you love the Lattimore because you're seeing the Greek through the Lattimore all the time.
Yes.
But if you don't know Greek, it's very confusing.
Well, now people, my colleague Pam Gordon, who wrote the introduction to my Sappho that just came out, a brilliant introduction. She went to Bryn Mawr, and Lattimore was there. She said, you know, when you would hear Lattimore read his Homer, it made perfect sense. And maybe that's what it takes, you know, to have the author, you know, who knows the cadences, you know, that he wants, and, you know, especially the enjambments and things like that.
I think that's actually true for these hexameter translations, that one of the problems is when you are not the author and you're reading them aloud, you stumble trying to find that.
You're trying to make,
But I think the authors themselves inhabit it so well that they could convince you that this really works.
So I had an experience at Emory a couple of years ago. They had a three-day reading of my Odyssey in the museum there. And they wanted to bring in as many black readers as they could, because it was, I forget exactly what the celebration was. But, you know, I was there, and I read the first book and the last book. And I wish I could remember his name now, who read book 22. And he read it. He was a very, very fine actor. He read it exactly the way I would read it. And I've never heard that before. I've listened to a lot of people read my Homer, these all-day Homer readings, you know, that kind of a plague almost.
Right. Yeah.
And I told him, I said, you know, this is uncanny. You know, did you listen to my recording? He said, no, and I didn't do that. I said, you read it exactly the way I wrote it, exactly the way I hear it. And he was very gracious. He said, well, it's all right there on the page. You know, how could you miss it? So that was very gratifying. When I was a graduate student at Texas, we recorded Iliad and Odyssey. for all day broadcast as a radio fundraiser, you know. So I assembled the cast and we get together and we're going to try Lattimore, you know, and we're trying. We're all experienced readers, you know. Couldn't do it, you know. We felt bad because we were all classicists, so we loved it. This is so close to the Greek, you know, and it just didn't work. And we went with Fitzgerald. So then the broadcast comes on, end of book one, Fitzgerald's translation. We read it. First phone call, you know, for the fundraiser. You're not using Lattimore. I'm not giving you a cent. Click.
Oh, wow.
You become attached to translations. You know, your people do. They really do.
I was wondering. Did you have that problem of becoming attached yourself? And I know this is, for example, something that German translators have talked about in the past of having to shake Voss out of their heads, you know.
Yeah.
But then they often have to come back to them because some of these expressions become so much a part of the target language.
Yes.
That you have to give up trying to just be different.
Yeah, you can't just be different. I think that's another trap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You never want to. Well, translators do pay homage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I finally did when I got to book 16 of the Iliad with Christopher Logue echoing in my mind. I had it all by heart. And, you know, I wasn't trying. Logue gave me a voice, as I said. And I said, it was especially it was Vanessa Redgrave reading Logue. That really is an odd thing, you know.
Quite compelling, yeah. I'd imagine.
Yeah, very compelling. But I would pay homage to Logue. Every now and then, I would use one of his phrases because it was, well, so perfect. There was no better way to say it. And it's exactly, I think, what I would have said anyway, even if I had not read Logue. But it was deliberate. It was a deliberate act.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you don't do it much at all, you know. Maybe 1/10 of 1% of the